Well, hey, did you know that there's an election this week? I don't know if you've noticed it. I don't know how many of you are into it. I'm not a super political person. I don't know a ton about politics, but this is for me, I think, such an interesting time as we just see there's so many candidates and parties who over the last couple of weeks have been trying to convince us all that they deserve our vote. And so if you've turned on the news or you've gone on online anywhere, read any articles, seen anything, there's probably been people who have come to your house, knocked on your door, your apartment, want to talk to you. They want to ask you things like, hey, can we count on your support? Can our party count on your support? Who are you voting for? Have you decided? All those kind of things. And if you've watched debates or anything like that, you can see people going at it over a bunch of different things. And I find it fascinating. It's interesting that I think big picture, we all want the same kind of things. Really big picture, we all want the same kind of things. I mean, it's an Ontario election, right? So we want Ontario to be a great place to live. We want it to be a better place to live. And then when we start getting kind of lower down on other levels, that's where we start disagreeing on. We disagree on things like, well, what does that actually look like? Practically speaking, what makes our province this place? What would make it a better place to live in for me and for you? And maybe we had different ideas about what that would look like. Then this is where maybe we get into some real tense moments sometimes, is we start trying to figure out how we're going to pay for it all. And if you watch some of those candidates, there's arguments about what actually makes our province a better place to live, and we can kind of talk about those things, although big picture, we're more or less, I think, we're geared other than how we're going to get there. But then how are we going to pay for it? That is, what are we going to invest in, and where's the money going to come from? And you got the taxes, and who's getting taxed, and how much, and where does the tax money go to, and is it efficient, and is the government doing the kind of things with the money that they're supposed to do? And we all start to disagree, and we all start to yell at each other, and they start to yell at each other and get mad at each other, and you're lying, and you're lying, and you don't have a responsible plan, and that's where politics can get sometimes really, really messy. Because we all want better in our lives. We all want better for the place that we live. We all want better relationships, better opportunities, those kind of things. But how we're going to do it and how we're going to pay for it is where things get tough and things get tense. And there's this moment in the life of Jesus, and as we've been working through this series in the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, that tells us about the life of Jesus, there's this turning point where kind of the whole book goes from one tone to another. The first part of the book, a lot of which we've worked through the last number of weeks, is, you know, we've talked about things that Jesus taught and things that he embodied. We talked about things where, you know, he healed people and parables where he's teaching people how to learn and how to learn about God and to experience it. And we saw him do some incredible things. And if you've been reading along in between the passages we haven't been able to get to, you see there's this drive in Jesus' life that people are attracted to, and you just go, that's amazing. He's healing those people, and he's feeding people, and he's compassionate, and he's gracious, and he's going for it, and he's teaching some amazing things. And sometimes you can read part of that book and just go, yeah, I don't know why anybody wouldn't go for this. But Jesus had a pretty clear idea of what he wants our world to look like and our relationships to look like. Jesus, you know, his life and his ministry is so wrapped up in different areas of life that all overlapped each other in his culture so much. There's the religious aspect, there's the political aspect, there's the spiritual aspect that were all coming in. And he was a figure that was speaking into all of those worlds that are kind of interconnected. And for the people of Israel, politics and religion were extremely connected. They were, you know, just almost entirely overlapped. And so you have this figure, Jesus, coming, and he's challenging people's beliefs. And he's in many ways setting himself up as someone that he wants people to look at him when it comes to figuring out politics and figuring out religion. And part of what he's doing is saying, you know, we separate those things in our world, but there's something deeper about who we are that we need to invest in order to live out our lives the way that we ought to in those arenas, those different arenas. And if you're wondering, well, what was Jesus' platform, right? We've talked in this series about the kingdom of God. He came and he announced the kingdom of God, that is God's will, God's reign, the fact that God's in charge, is available to you right now, that you can start living as if God is in charge, because God is in charge. No matter what we see here, even when it doesn't look like in this world, you can start living under the rule and the reign of God. He's taking over this world. That's available to you. But what does that look like? If you're wondering, what's his platform? Okay, Jesus, what's it supposed to look like? What are you going to do? Great place to start. We don't have time for this morning, but read the Sermon on the Mount. It's found in Matthew chapter 5 to 7. And it's Jesus' most famous sermon, one that's preserved for us in writing, one of the most complete pictures of what we have of Jesus teaching and teaching about how we relate to God, how we relate to other people, how we check our hearts. And he really sets out some ideals there. And we're going to wrestle in our lives with those ideals because life isn't ideal. But he puts out these ideals of here's what it ought to look like, and here's what God is working towards to make life look like. Here's what real prosperity looks like. And it's not just this financial wealth thing. There's something much deeper and relational in terms of how you relate to God and other people. He just fleshes out what it looks like to have better, and what really deep down in our souls is satisfying. I think he lays out a platform that if we experienced it truly and we reflected the values in that sermon, we would experience what true life is like. And it's this picture of, I believe what he's saying, one day God will fully institute into this world. And for those who have trust in Jesus and follow him, we will experience that one day. But where we're at in the book of Mark, there's this turn because you have his platform. We see that all over the place, but the Sermon on the Mount's a pretty great place to start to look at that. And then there's the question of how you're going to pay for it. How are you going to make it happen? Hey, it's great to put some ideals out there. It's great to say that we all ought to have this powerful connection with God that drives our life and gives us life. And we ought to have this harmonious relationship with other people. You go, yeah, great. Who's not signing up for that? Big picture. We all agree. That sounds wonderful. But how are we going to get there? How are we going to pay for that? Who are we going to tax for that? Who's going to write the check? And there's this moment in the end of chapter 8 in Mark, where we've been, where Jesus, he's got his closest followers, his disciples around him, and kind of for the first time, he tells them how this is going to come about, how he's going to pay for this. And it's this unbelievable moment. If you think that some of the things that we've already talked about in this series, like I said, we talked about some teachings and healings and different ways that Jesus was interacting with people. If you think that those things are unexpected, and they are, how Jesus said he was going to enact his kingdom was incredibly unexpected. In fact, when he told his closest followers, his disciples, how he was gonna bring the kingdom into this world, they couldn't believe him at first. Jesus, at the end of chapter 8 in Mark, told his disciples that he was going to be arrested, beaten, and crucified. And Peter, and in the book of Mark, by the way, we believe that Peter is sort of the underlying, it's his perspective that's been written down, that it was Peter's kind of stories about Jesus and the things he experienced that ended up being written down for us in Mark, primarily that drives that book, and the different gospels come from slightly different perspectives, other people. But Peter gets up, and Jesus has just said that he's going to be crucified. So picture, we're in election week. Imagine that somebody came to you, and they go, here's my platform. Here's what I want Ontario to look like. And you go, oh, that sounds like a wonderful place. I'd love to live there. How are you going to pay for that? What are you going to do? And they're like, well, I'm going to run on this platform and it's going to be so scandalous that everybody else is going to gang up and kill me. Can I count on your vote? Will you follow me? And then Jesus says this, if you want to come and follow me, you need to take up your cross as well and follow. You need to be willing to come where I'm going and experience what I'm experiencing. So Peter gets up and it says that he rebuked Jesus. You can't say that. You're a religious leader and a political leader and we're counting on you, and that doesn't happen to people who win. That's what happens, not even to people who lose. That's what happens to the scandalous people, the revolters, the revolutionaries that aren't powerful enough to get their agenda forward but are such a threat that they're executed. Jesus, you cannot say those kind of things. And this is the turning point in Mark where Jesus says for the first time to his disciples, here's what's going to happen and I need to know, are you coming with me? Will you take up your cross and follow? I don't think that there's a way to soft pedal this. And if there was, I wouldn't be interested in it. Jesus doesn't say, hey, if you follow me, then it's just going to be healings and feedings all the time. That's part of it, and a great, powerful part of it. But Jesus looked at those who were deciding to follow him, really follow him, and said, I want you to know where we're going. And I want you to know that I'm going to the cross. That's how I'm going to pay for this. That's how we're going to find real, true life, is that we're going to die to all the things that might draw us away from what is experientially true life. And we'll be willing to give up anything that takes us off the path, and the path is to the cross. And Peter gets up and he says, you can't say that. How dare you say that? He rebuked him. And then we come to this passage in Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 2. If you want to turn there, if you have a Bible or an app on your phone. And it's a passage that is really important to know the context of what we just talked about, of what's been going on. Kind of a confusing passage sometimes if you've been trying to read through it, but I think it's a real powerful one. And so after that conversation that Jesus had with his disciples, that really hard turning point, and we know that now, even from a literary perspective in the book of Mark, everything shifts now towards the cross. That Mark's focus in writing this book now, it's hey, we're going full tilt right to the cross now. This is where the entire message is going and focusing, and everything that he writes is going to be gearing us towards that. So after that conversation where Jesus announced that, this is what it says. Mark chapter 9, verse 2. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and led them up a high mountain to be alone. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance was transformed, and his clothes became dazzling white, far whiter than any earthly bleach could ever make them. Then Elijah and Moses appeared and began talking with Jesus. There is in this, I mean, this. If you just read this, you might say, what's going on here? This is such a weird thing, such a weird story, and why is this happening, and why are we written about it? Is it just to kind of show off that God does, you know, things that we can't describe or whatever? But there is so much packed into this in terms of the background for these Jewish men in their Bibles of what's happening. And there's so much that if we do a little bit of research, we do a little bit of digging, we find out that there's a really powerful message in what's going on. So Jesus draws Peter, James, and John, kind of his inner circle of disciples, and they go up a mountain to be alone. And then you have this transformation of Jesus. This story is often referred to as the transfiguration, that something about his appearance was completely changed. And all of a sudden, Elijah and Moses show up. A little bit of history here to go in the background. What are we talking about? Moses was called to meet with God on a mountain, and he came back with the law. There's a story, and there's actually a couple of stories within a story of where God calls Moses up. He's the leader. This is hundreds of years before Jesus, but he's the leader of the Israelites, and he goes up the mountain in order to communicate with God so that then he can come and tell the people what God has told them. So he goes up there, and he has these different interactions, and one of them is he wants to see God, and God says, I'll show you myself, but you can't see me face to face. That there's just going to be too much for you, that you can't handle that. God is too holy. And so Moses is hid in the cleft of a rock, kind of like a cave or whatever, and it says that God passes by and that Moses sees him from behind and understands his character, who he is. But Moses goes up and he speaks to God, and he comes down with the law, which is the stipulations or the covenant between God and the people. This is God saying, here's how we're going to live together. This is what I'm going to do for you, and this is how you're being called to live. And Moses came down, and when he came down the mountain, said that his face was shining, you know, like he had been, like, it's like a spiritual sunburn, like it's radiant. And he had to put a veil down in front of his face because there's this powerful glow. And he came down with the law. Here's how you're supposed to live. This is what our society is going to be based on. Elijah was called to meet with God on a mountain, and he came back with the promise of restoration. Elijah was a prophet in the history of Israel, and he lived at a time and prophesied at a time where the people had turned away from the law that Moses had brought and taught them, and people were no longer living by it, and people were doing whatever they wanted, and their society was in shambles, and they weren't treating each other right, and there were huge consequences, and everything was going wrong. And Elijah, he came on the scene to kind of call people back. That's what prophets were supposed to do. We think a lot of times prophets, their job is to foretell the future. That's not really their job. Their job is to say, I'm calling you back to live right because this is going in a bad direction. But if you come back to God, if you come back to living the way that God's called you to, then God will come and be with you again. That's what the prophets in Israel's history did. And so Elijah comes back at a time like that, and he's calling people back, and it's just a horrible scene to the point where there's these people who are worshiping another god, and there's this huge fight, and Elijah ends up slaughtering a bunch of these people. Like, it's a huge mess. But Elijah is called to a mountain in the midst of this time, and one of the problems they were having was there was no rain, and they were suffering for it, and these people were worshiping Baal, the rain god, the storm god, and they were asking Baal to bring this, and this was so offensive to the God of Israel. And so Elijah challenged them. And they prayed to their god, Baal, and they tried to get his attention, and they cut themselves and bled, because that was their tradition, is that, man, maybe we'll get his attention, maybe he'll pay attention to us if we cut ourselves, if we sacrifice, if we do something right. But they couldn't get rain, and Elijah, powerfully through God, calls down the rain in this miraculous way, and then things don't get better. And Elijah's disillusioned, and he can't believe it. He says, God showed up, and he showed him the power, but people aren't changing. And he goes up a mountain, and God promises that there's going to be restoration. God promises that even in the midst of the people being unfaithful to him, that God would be faithful, and God would show up. And even if it's going to get rough down the road, God is going to be there and call people back to him. And he would hold a certain number of people to himself that would keep everything going. He wouldn't abandon them. Moses and Elijah together represent the entire law and prophets. They represent, here in our story with Jesus, the Bible. Okay, they are heavyweights. When people in Jesus' culture referred to their Bible, which is our Old Testament, they called it the law and the prophets. And another way of saying the law, or the Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible, they call it the law. And it's not just laws, there's stories in there, but that's how they referred to it. And another way of saying that is the book of Moses. It's all about Moses. He's the main character, and he's who God used. He is, like, so symbolic of that entire historical time that the people were following Moses. And Elijah, they do the same thing when they talked about all the prophets. Elijah sometimes was just a stand-in for the prophets, because these are the two of the biggest heavyweights in their tradition, their religious and political tradition, Moses and Elijah. So you get up to the mountain, and Jesus, all of a sudden, he's changed. And then Moses and Elijah show up, and it's a way of Mark letting us know that this is like the biggest theological conversation discussion that you could ever imagine. It's Jesus, and it's Moses and Elijah. It's the law and the prophets. It's the Bible. It's everything that these people were supposed to kind of base their life on, and how they were supposed to live in terms of God's revealed word written down. They're there, and here's James and John and Peter just like bewildered. So it says in verse 5, Peter exclaimed. And remember, you know, this is kind of Peter's perspective, but Peter gets set up as like the dumb guy in these stories. So in order, I think a lot of times for the book to say, okay, now we need some explanation, they kind of throw Peter out there to be like, Peter says something stupid, then we can explain it so everybody else understands. Poor Peter, right? No, it is what it is. Peter exclaims, Rabbi, teacher, it's wonderful for us to be here. Let's make three shelters as memorials, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He said this because he didn't really know what else to say, for they were all terrified. You ever done that? Why did you say that? I didn't know what else to say. The awkward silence was killing me. I had to say something. That's Peter here. But it gives us an opportunity to figure this out. Now, before we're too hard on Peter, though, I think he understands a little bit more than most of us would clue into, but he's also made a key mistake. And so we read this and go, he didn't really know what he was saying. You go, oh, Peter, you're such a dummy. But Peter was probably cluing into a powerful tradition. He just missed the conclusion. So there's this Psalm 43:3. There's this poem that, again, if you're a Jewish man in this context, you probably all knew that all these guys here would have known, that became really important. Psalm 43, verse 3 says this, send out your light and your truth. This is kind of, the psalmist writing a poem speaking to God. Send out your light and your truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill and to your dwelling. So there was a Jewish midrash, and a midrash is an interpretation of a text. So just like you can go find commentaries on the Bible, people have written things, this is what this means and what this means. They had that, and the Jewish people were really good at that and very creative with that. And so there was a midrash from Psalm 43, verse 3, that when it says, send out your light and truth, had a couple things to say about it. One is they would say, light and truth, if we look back to the time where our people were enslaved to Egypt, refers to Moses and Aaron. And so they're being creative. They're saying, what was the psalmist trying to say? Well, remember that time where we were enslaved in Egypt? You know, what was our light and truth? Who did God use to lead us? Because that's the next part of that verse, right? He leads us. He leads us and leads us to a holy hill where they ended up going eventually, where Moses went up. And so they say the light and truth in Egypt was Moses and Aaron. That's who God used. And they went to a holy hill, and they met with God there. And you know what happened when Moses came down the mountain and he had the law? They set up a big tent, a tabernacle, which is the same word for dwelling, a dwelling place, or a tabernacle, a big tent. And they actually ended up taking that tent with them wherever they went through the desert. And when they camped somewhere, they set it up, and it was where God was supposed to dwell and live. And then they said, in the Midrash, that light and truth for the next generation. Well, now if we're looking forward, it's Elijah and it's the Messiah. And so we have named Moses and Moses' kind of helper, assistant, Aaron. But then if we're looking forward, it's Elijah. It's this great prophet. And not Elijah, the one that we know, but one like Elijah is what they refer to, that somebody else, a great prophet, will come. And the Messiah, the one who God has commissioned to bring his kingdom to this world, the one we've been waiting for, the one that we can't name yet because we don't know who it is. So Peter is on a hill that you might want to think of as a holy hill because he's meeting there with God. He's seeing Moses and Elijah with Jesus, the Messiah, and he's sitting there going, now when I think of that verse, send out your light and truth, Moses and Aaron, Elijah and the Messiah, let them lead me, let them bring you to your holy hill, which we're on right now, if you're Peter, and to your tent, your dwelling. So Peter says, let's put up some tents, one for Moses, one for Elijah, and one for you, because I know that verse, light and truth, leading us. We're there. He's got it. And this sets up the expectation of Jesus as the Messiah. But Peter misses the point. Making tents is to commemorate the place and moment rather than the mission. That's where he's missed it. I think he got it right when he's realizing, hey, all this is happening, and there were people that were kind of interpreting this, and this is part of that story, and oh, now it's happening, and it's God saying, here's the Messiah, here's the one we've been waiting for, and look, it's Moses and Elijah, and they're all giving credibility to Jesus. I think he gets that. Where he misses it, he goes, great, so now we need to build another tent, just like they did in the Old Testament, where God can be and where God's Messiah is, and that's the hey, look at this mountain in this moment, we got to remember this, and I'm sure people will come here to these tents and worship. But Jesus is going to call them to mission. In fact, Jesus had just called them to mission. Remember, he said, we're going to the cross. Are you coming with me? You want to pick up your cross and follow me? We're not staying up here on a mountain. It's not about just this little discussion. This is a commissioning for the mission. We're going to the cross. And the last story was Peter saying, you can't say that kind of stuff. And now we get to this point where he's standing there and seeing this interaction between God and the biggest heavyweights they could imagine in their religious history. And the point is, this is happening. And this is the way of God. This is what needs to happen. The cross needs to happen. So in verse 7 it says, then a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my dearly loved son. Listen to him. And suddenly when they looked around, Moses and Elijah were gone, and they saw only Jesus with them. This is a point in which God, on display for those who are watching, is now giving Jesus authority, letting them know. He actually almost verbatim that same message at Jesus' baptism we read. This is my son. It's the one I've chosen. listen to him, follow him. Now we get it again. He's just announced we're going to the cross, and they go, can't believe that. Can't believe that we would follow a Messiah to the cross where he would be killed. We hear this voice, God coming, saying, this is my son, dearly loved. Listen to him. What's happening is that God is signaling the authority of Jesus, and not as one voice amongst Moses and Elijah, but as the authoritative voice that they were pointing towards. Right? All of a sudden, Moses and Elijah disappear, and it's Jesus. And this has been read throughout the scriptures, and Jesus himself taught this. It's one of the reasons people got so mad. He says, when you read Moses, when you read Elijah, when you read the prophets, they're all pointing towards me. They're all incomplete until me. I will show you that all these stories and all these laws and all this stuff were pointing towards me. And so you have the Bible literally show up with Jesus, and then they disappear, and it's just Jesus. And God says, listen to him. This is my authoritative word for you. And this is powerful for us, because I'll tell you, and I say this every now and then, you can take the Bible and make it say anything that you want. You can find a verse for almost anything. You can justify almost any action. People have, and we do, justify terrible and horrible atrocities because of things they read in this, how they interpret it. And it's powerful to read this verse, and God says, here we go. I know you can get really tied up in Moses and Elijah. You need to study it. But listen, you need to know all that's pointing to Jesus. Now listen to him. And he will show you the way. And he will show you authoritatively and definitively what God is like. If you're asking the question, what God like? Listen to Jesus. And I'll tell you what it looks like. And I'll tell you what the context of this story is. Why I started with that conversation about the cross. Is because what Mark is trying to signal us into, and what Jesus was trying to teach his disciples and continues to teach us today, is that the character of God is cruciform. Cruciform is a fancy word that means cross-shaped. What is God like? What is his character? How does he do things? What's his platform for the world? And how is he going to pay for it? It's cruciform. It's all going to come in the shape of the cross. Listening to Jesus means that we accept the very difficult premise that the way of the cross is the way of God and the way of God's people. How is God going to do what God is doing? How is God going to rescue the world? How is God going to bring restoration to our planet? How is God going to bind up the relationships that are broken amongst us? How is God going to interact with evil in the world, stop it, and bring justice? How is God going to bring mercy? How is God going to transform evil? How is God bringing light into the dark places? How is God going to interact with you? It's going to be cruciform, cross-shaped, but we can't believe that. We can't believe that if God showed up, he would willingly die at the hands of the people who would kill us. We rebuke Jesus, at least Peter did. And then here's Jesus standing on the mountain, transformed, and Elijah and Moses disappear, and God says, you listen to him. And it's going to look cross-shaped, cruciform. It's going to mean that God will willingly absorb all of the evil and injustice in the world onto himself, that he will put it to death in the death of Jesus Christ, and that 3 days later he would rise again and defeat all of it to offer life to anyone who would follow. I want to ask you a hard question. If you're not a Christian, and you haven't decided to take up a cross, I get today, I told you, I can't soft pedal that. I don't know how else to say that. That's what Jesus calls us to. And you're welcome to take your time in thinking about that and what it means for you. And we have a heart here to talk to people about what that looks like in our lives, because I'm going to talk about this in a minute. I believe that in taking up our cross, we find real, true, deep, meaningful, eternal life that is better than anything else you could ever imagine. If you're not there yet, I encourage you to continue to journey through that, ask questions, and to think about it, and to know that when Jesus calls us to follow him, he doesn't call us to a couple nice, easy religious things. He calls us to come and die to ourselves and to the things that take us away from God and the things that hurt each other and to accept his grace as he welcomes us in forgivingly and graciously through the cross. And I want you to know that that invitation is available to you today and always. It will also mean, and for those of us who have taken that step and made that decision, it also means that it's not only God's way, but it's the way that God calls us to live, cruciform. So here's my really tough question for you if you're a follower of Christ today. Is there an area of your life that needs to take a more cross-like shape? Is there a relationship? Is there an attitude? Is there an action? Is there thoughts that you know need to become more cross-like? Two ways I want you to think about that. Do you need to receive it? And do you need to reflect it? Today, do you need to receive what Jesus did on the cross? Absorbing all of the things that we've done that have brought pain into the lives of other people. All the things that draw us away from God. All of the things that are offensive to him. And to say that Jesus has paid for it. We receive it. To allow him to fill those spaces up in your life with grace and forgiveness, with love and compassion, with mercy, with a God who says, I was willing to take it. So counterintuitive that the world would never understand, many people in the world will never understand how, you know, it's a stumbling block and foolishness to think that God himself would be crucified. We would never expect God to be crucified. Do you need to receive that today and know that God loves you? We sang it earlier that God's made a way for you to him. That God wants to breathe by his spirit restoration into your life where it's needed. Is there something where you definitely need to receive the cross-shaped love of God for specifically in your life today? It's available to you. Do you need to reflect it? Are there people that the way that you treat them needs to change? Are there thoughts that you have about yourself or somebody else in which you realize is not cross-shaped at all? Might be shaped like everybody in the world expects you to act or think or believe, but are you willing to take up your cross and say, this becomes the shape of my life as I accept it, I receive it, I also reflect it? Is there an area of your life that needs to take a more cruciform, cross-shaped shape? We might expect oftentimes, if you just thought about how is God going to do things in this world, what does it look like for him to show up? We might expect Moses and Elijah. We might expect that God dictates laws for us that we must follow. We might expect, as Elijah tried to enact, that he would just obliterate our enemies, that he would call us to fight, to revenge, to kill, to oppose, to have this attitude like we've got it right and everybody else has got it wrong and our enemies will push aside, we'll go after. That's, Elijah did that in part of his life. We might expect that that's what God is like. But not if we believe this. Not if we believe in the cruciform Jesus. Because the cross means that forgiveness is more effective than revenge. The cross means that sacrifice is more valuable than security. The cross means that service is more influential than power. The cross means that humility is more majestic than pride. The cross means that grace is more powerful than any and all of our effort. The cross means that in order to truly live, you must be willing to die. But when you go to Jesus, to the cross, you experience Jesus in the empty tomb. That the cross is payment and the empty tomb is power. That the cross gets its value and power in the resurrection. And there, friends, is true life. When we're willing to abandon everything else that takes us away from God, everything else that loses its value in light of what is truly value, when we're willing to totally surrender and give ourselves up to God, when we're willing to grab our cross and say, whatever this means, I abandon my reputation, I abandon my ambition, I abandon my sin, I abandon my pride, I abandon my rights, I abandon my life for Christ and for His gospel's sake, for His invitation, the good news. Then Jesus taught His disciples, when you lose your life for my sake and the sake of the gospel, then you will find it. And that's what I long for in my life and in your lives and in our world, the powerful cruciform message of hope. Heavenly Father, this is totally unexpected when we listen to it with fresh ears. Today I pray that the power of your cross would invade our hearts and our minds by your Holy Spirit in a way that we could never leave this as an abstract theological principle, but that we would see in the shape of the cross the shape of your heart, your love poured into our lives, your forgiveness and grace available to us, the power that comes in your Son giving Himself up for the hope of the world, and the power of His resurrection that is life for all. I pray that today there might be some who are investigating this for the first time, that they might know, and that you might draw them close to you so that they know you and the power of the resurrection. And I pray for each one of us today, that our lives might mirror the life of Christ and be lived in the shape of a cross.